Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, in a brutal confirmation of the Trump administration's hard line on refugees, Attorney General Jeff Sessions ordered immigration judges to stop granting asylum to people who are victims of gang violence or domestic abuse. Sessions is trying to use his office to sharply change U.S. immigration law. Next, Spain yesterday offered to take in a humanitarian ship stranded in international waters with 629 refugees aboard, including hundreds of children and seven pregnant women. As the new Italian government and Malta refused to let it dock. Spain's new socialist prime minister, Pedro Sanchez, said that he will allow the ship to dock in Valencia. The refugees today boarded another ship and are now on their way to Spain. Then the Red Cross and the UN have pulled out of the Yemeni city of Al-Hudaydah. How bad is the situation they're going to get? And then we continue our weekly Wednesday series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel unpacks the low unemployment rate and what it means for workers, and he discusses Social Security dipping into its reserves. And finally, Maine has instituted ranked choice voting, or instant runoff voting, which some argue is more fair than most voting systems used here in the United States. The first statewide vote with ranked choice is taking place today in Maine. How does it work, and is it more fair? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. In a brutal confirmation of the Trump administration's hard line on refugees, Attorney General Jeff Sessions ordered immigration judges to stop granting asylum to people who are victims of gang violence or domestic abuse. Sessions is trying to use his office to sharply change U.S. immigration law. We're joined from Los Angeles by Danielle Norwood. She is a reproductive rights activist and a therapist specializing in treating adult and adolescent survivors of trauma. Welcome back, Danielle.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
You know, one of the bright spots of U.S. immigration policy over the years, at least over recent years, has been that we do allow refugees in the sense that they are crossing borders because they're victims of either gang violence or domestic abuse to come to this country and to be resettled in this country. What kind of an impact is this going to have on people?
It's a death sentence. You know, he has, with a pen stroke, condemned tens of thousands of women and children to death. You know, these are people who are fleeing violence so extreme and without protection in their home countries that they're willing to move to a different country. You know, that's not a flippant decision. And we know that, you know, there are currently tens of thousands of women waiting for hearings. So it's a pretty direct effect that this ruling will have, you know, that one person can in a moment make a decision that's so momentous. It's really horrifying.
Is there any recourse, or is this something that we're just going to have to get used to until Congress has the courage to change the law?
Well, what it looks like right now is asylum seekers will be stopped at the border and they won't even get a hearing. And there are many thousands of people sort of waiting for their hearings right now, and we don't really know what will happen with them. So I think, you know, this is the kind of thing that is one of those things we talk about that you don't get to vote on. You know, we don't get to participate in this part of the government. So this is a decision that was made. You know, the common story of like, well, we'll just vote these guys out. We don't have that option with Jeff Sessions. You know, and growing up, he has been in office. He was the attorney general in Alabama. First, he was like for the district court or whatever, where I grew up in the Black Belt. So since the year I was born, 1981, he has been in office. And so for me, he's like this longstanding kind of negative figure in government who seems unstoppable. You know, and in Alabama, he was elected, but he was appointed to this position. And so it's been sort of this slow horror for me, you know, seeing this person who was always, in my mind, a negative figure, you know, because of the decisions that he made and the attacks that he made on Black voters in Alabama, on LGBT student activists in Alabama. You know, he has a record of coming after the most vulnerable. And so to see him gaining more and more power to the point where he can assign a case to himself, overturn this decision, and put all these lives in danger, you know, on a personal level has been really, really horrifying.
Jeff Sessions is really one of like the worst villains of the Trump administration. And that's kind of saying something.
He's an easy boogeyman.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's like George Wallace, right? I mean, right. He comes out of that political tradition. Wouldn't you agree, Danielle?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's unfortunately a political tradition in Alabama, you know, from the Southern strategy, but even before that, I think there is this trend of sort of negative, dark populism that's always been there. So it's just, I think we always thought, well, it's Alabama, you know, we have this tradition of George Wallace. Our government's always been corrupt. So to see it on a national level is alarming. But you're right, he's a cartoonish villain, right down to the accent. You know, I angrily posted on Facebook that I grew up in the exact same place as him. I know exactly what kind of person he is, right down to the affected plantation accent. You know, he characterizes himself as this villainous figure. He makes the choice to align himself against the people. So yeah, he's a real bad guy.
And Danielle, why was this enacted administratively? Why did this not have to be an act of Congress?
Because apparently the Justice Department has control over this and not the courts. I'm not really clear on how he can do this.
Yeah, I was wondering. Well, I know that immigration judges are answerable to the Justice Department because I think that they're categorized or classified as administrative law judges. Is that right? I wonder if that's right. I think that's the case. And if that's the case, that's why he could do this as a policy change rather than having to send it to Congress. Either way, I think it's a very dangerous development, because imagine the power and the authority that this one man has over all these people. We're talking potentially about thousands and thousands of people who are going to be sent back to the places from which they've fled, only to face the same violence that they were facing when they fled.
Yeah, and there's some really questionable talk in a lot of the mainstream media coverage about how civilized the United States is, you know, and cultures of machismo and family violence and, you know, sort of separating us from other countries. And, you know, that's not really based in fact, given the United States record on domestic violence. You know, we have very few protections here. And what we have, we fought for. Women did it for themselves. You know, we didn't have shelters before the 1970s. And it was because women in the late 70s recognized the need, and people who weren't, you know, experts, who weren't trained, who weren't lawyers or even therapists, were coming together to form this network of shelters. You know, everything we had to fight for. We didn't even have marital rape laws, which is one of the things that they bring up that's so, you know, terrible about other countries. It was like 1993 before marital rape, so-called, was illegal in every state. So there's a little bit of talk that feels disingenuous around the difference between the United States and other places. But nevertheless, these people are fleeing violence. They're trying to get out of these bad situations. And he's treating it as quote unquote private violence, which is language that we heard decades ago. You know, it's this idea that what happens in the home is a private matter and it's not the government's job or responsibility to intervene. So that's the philosophy that he's turning us back to, you know, and it's part of this greater attack on immigrants and immigration. But what this specific decision does, what Jeff Sessions is reverting to, is this idea that women are the property of their husbands and what he decides to do is his decision, you know, and it's a death sentence for all these people who are trying to flee violence. You know, I cannot imagine how difficult it must be to leave everything that you know, to leave your home country, because you cannot escape someone who is trying to kill you. And we know that intimate partner violence escalates. We know, you know, patriarchal terrorism is another name for it. We know that it escalates until it ends in death.
UPI said something that was interesting today, or they reported something interesting, and they said that after issuing this order, Sessions backpedaled a little bit. And what he said was, it says here that he used a case involving a victim of domestic violence from El Salvador as a precedent, that victims of what he called private crimes are not eligible for asylum under U.S. law, and that they have to prove that the government condoned the private actions or demonstrated an inability to protect the victims. And he said, the mere fact that a country may have problems effectively policing certain crimes, such as domestic violence or gang violence, or that certain populations are more likely to be victims of crimes, cannot in itself establish an asylum claim. So he's effectively cutting most people out. I suppose if you're from a country that we don't have good relations with, I guess, and you can prove that the government, as a matter of policy, either can't or won't protect you, maybe then you have a shot at asylum. But this is gonna affect a lot of people adversely. And I'm not seeing any wiggle room here, really.
Yeah, and he's ignoring, you know, reports from the State Department, from the American Bar Association, all these sort of professional groups and government groups that are saying, like, that's not true. you know, he's directly defying a lot of evidence. You know, it is very subjective and very difficult to prove that the government isn't responding or isn't protecting people. And as you said, it's an accusation that tends to be leveled at countries the United States is preparing to go to war with. You know, it's one of the propaganda tactics that they use, you know, leading up to the first Iraq war. There was the false story about babies being thrown out of incubators. You know, they use protecting women as an excuse to bomb these countries, you know, but it's as false as the rest of the pro-life so-called narrative. You know, these are people, Jeff Sessions in particular, who positions himself as this sort of Christian figure, as someone who's concerned with the sanctity of life. And he's, you know, he's directly responsible for the harm that comes to these people. And there will be, you know, terrible, terrible consequences to this decision.
We have just under a minute left. There's one other piece of Jeff Sessions, his record of attacks on women's rights and equality, that I wanted to bring out. And that's that he actually opposed the Violence Against Women Act. I mean, how could somebody possibly take that position?
Yeah. And the Violence Against Women Act, it was hard fought, for sure. It was won in, I believe, 1993, which is, you know, I was thinking about it yesterday. So much of the gains that we've made have been within my lifetime. You know, it is so recent that we've won any protections at all. From what I remember, I think his position against reauthorizing it was strictly a budget one. And that's sort of what he's doing here. He's treating it as a legal issue and not a human rights issue. And I think in that case, he was looking at the budget and not protecting women. He seems to be compartmentalizing, or, you know, sort of not recognizing the human impact of these decisions and these positions.
We're out of time. We're going to leave it there. We were joined from Los Angeles by Danielle Norwood. She is a reproductive rights activist and a therapist specializing in treating adult and adolescent survivors of trauma. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Spain yesterday offered to take in a humanitarian ship stranded in international waters with 629 refugees aboard, including hundreds of children and seven pregnant women, as the new Italian government and Malta refused to let it dock. Spain's new socialist prime minister, Pedro Sanchez, said he will allow the ship to dock in Valencia, and the refugees today boarded another ship and are now on their way to Spain. We're joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols, the correspondent for Spain and for Catalonia at Green Left Weekly. Welcome back, Dick.
Nice to be here.
Dick, this has become something of a football in Southern Europe. The Italians didn't want the ship. The Maltese didn't want the ship. Certainly the French didn't want the ship. And finally, the Spanish agreed to take it. Is this a one-time issue, or is this something we're going to continue to see more of?
It's a difficult question to answer because, of course, the Spanish take a lot of refugees come across the Gibraltar Straits, and that's probably not publicized in the States.
Yeah, in fact, they take more per capita than the Italians and the Maltese.
I'm not sure about that, but it could well be true. But there's different routes, refugee routes. I mean, the big one we're talking about is from Libya, which is where all the poor people have been in the wars in Syria come through. What will happen in future is, first of all, it won't be a one-off, because basically the Socialist Party and the left as a whole here, and even Citizens, which is a, you know, right-wing party, a new right party, And they said this was the right thing to do. Only the PP, the People's Party, have come out and said, oh, this could be the big thin end of the wedge. We could be just another Italy flooded by refugees, et cetera, et cetera. But what you have in Spain is a very special sort of attitude to refugees, which is that because of the civil war here, everybody remembers that a lot of people in Spain, like, you know, up to half the population, were the victims of the civil war, and hundreds of thousands of those were refugees, just as an indication of the sentiment. The biggest demonstration ever for refugee rights in the world was held here in Barcelona last year. And that was, you know, 300,000, 400,000 people. So there's a very strong sentiment for refugees. These refugees will be automatically housed. The Catalan government has 1,500 places. The councils of Valencia, these are the progressive councils of Valencia, Barcelona and other places, have offered places, permanent housing for refugees. This has actually been on offer while there was the PP government, but the PP government just didn't fulfil their quota as established by the European Union. So I think there will be, just to answer your question, I think this won't just be a one-off, but that it does mean that the whole refugee issue will become more of a political hot potato in the Spanish state, because, of course, we have racists here. We have all the people who, you know, the proportions are different, but the people who voted for the Lega Nord in Italy, they exist here as much as anywhere else.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, all across Europe, we've seen the rise of new far-right parties that either didn't exist before, you know, in recent years, or were very, very marginal and sort of blew up. So the Alliance for Germany is an example of that. The Northern League in Italy, you know, really rose to prominence, and now their leader, Matteo Salvini, is the interior minister of Italy, and therefore sort of the person directly responsible for dealing with the refugee and migrant issues, which is, I think, just a terrible thing. But in Spain, you know, there has been a new formation on the political right. It was Citizens, but like you were saying, you know, they haven't adopted this sort of like extreme far-right, hardline, anti-immigrant, anti-refugee positions. I mean, why is that in Spain? I mean, is it that the PP, the Popular Party, which, you know, is kind of like the mainstream conservative party, is it because within that formation there's a far-right faction? I mean, talk about just sort of the history of how the current political system in Spain developed and why you think it's been sort of resistant to the formation of a new far-right party.
I think we can. The answer to that is quite simple, verbally simple. You can put it in words easily enough. We don't need to scapegoat refugees or even Muslims because we scapegoat each other here. That is to say, the Castilians can scapegoat the Catalans. Then we can say it's the problem of the Basques, the ETA terrorism, or it's the problem. The problem is of those lazy people down in Andalusia who don't do any work but lie around in bars all day. That is to say, racial stereotyping is alive and well in Spain, but it's not directed outwards. It's directed to other communities in the Spanish state. So the biggest racial sentiment, xenophobic sentiment here, is not direct. There's some towards the Moors, what they call the Moors, people from North Africa and the Maghreb, but it's even that's not anything compared to the sort of strong sentiment that's whipped up by the national question in the Spanish state, which makes this place different to anywhere else in Western Europe and closest to somewhere like Turkey. And see, Turkey, where you have the whole Kurdish question, Turkey has actually taken in, a million refugees, more than a million refugees from Syria. The whole way that xenophobia and racism plays out as a political weapon and as a way of manipulating working people in the society, which is what it's all designed to do, of course, is different depending on the sort of history of these countries, in particular whether they are plurinational states.
Dick, do you see or foresee any political fallout from the Prime Minister's decision to take these refugees?
I think the majority of sentiment here, and I'm just looking at the screen here, I'm just trying to find see if there's been any opinion polling on this, but I can't find anything, but I would think that the immediate response, just talking to people in the street, is, oh, good, we're not like those Italians. The people here are very upset about the evolution of politics in Italy because of the strong sentiment, you know, the anti-fascist tradition in Italy and the anti-Francoist tradition here. So progressive people here are very, very upset about that. And they're also bemused by the fact that, you know, the so-called progressive five-star movement could make a government with these scumbags from the Northern League. But anyway, that's all beside the point. But that's the immediate political reaction, to answer your question directly, is the immediate political reaction is pleasure. Good, that's good. And remember, too, this government has been in power 1 week, so it's looking to get some brownie points, as we say in Australia. It's looking to get some runs on the board, and this is going to be, you know, welcome not just in the left but in right across, I would think, a big majority of the Spanish population would be in favour of this decision.
The refugee crisis, I think, was caused in large part by Western intervention, military intervention in large parts of the world, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Syria. And, you know, you mentioned Libya earlier. You know, of course, NATO just destroyed that country. Spain is a NATO member. You know, it's gone along with U.S. interventions. I believe it was the government of Jose Maria Aznar, who agreed to be part of the George W. Bush administration's invasion of Iraq. What do people think in terms of the Spanish state's foreign policy? What are attitudes towards that? And do people see the connection with the refugee crisis going on in the world?
That's understood very, I think it's just in the broad left, you know, and that includes the PSOE, the Socialist Party, even beyond. The fact that where these refugees coming from is all understood as, you know, they're economic refugees. People understand what's driving the whole refugee crisis and all the component causes, because there's economic refugees, a lot of economic refugees coming from sub-Saharan Africa because of utter misery in sub-Saharan Africa. But people relate to that because of there are a lot of internal refugees, internal migration in Spain after the Civil War, because it was either move to somewhere else or die of starvation. So these people have had the experience, or their families have had the experience. It's not something that, you know, it's just old foreigners. Now, it's not like, you know, a common attitude in the United States towards Mexicans, or caricature of things, but it's not like that. So yeah, that's the sort of attitude here. It's, and I'm just repeating myself, but the refugee, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because in Hungary, refugees are just felt as a threat. It's a threat. It's, you know, xenophobia at a very intense level. Here, the reaction is poor bastards. You know, we went through this. Yes, there's xenophobia. Yeah, and obviously, if it built up, if there was a big influx of refugees and it wasn't controlled, wasn't organized properly, there would be an increase in xenophobia. But that's not where we are at the moment.
Well, that was the voice of Dick Nichols. He joined us from Barcelona. Dick is the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
The Red Cross and the United Nations have pulled out of the Yemeni city of Al-Hudaydah. How bad is the situation in Yemen going to get? We're joined from Beirut by independent political analyst Marwa Osman. Marwa, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Marwa, the situation in Hudaydah has humanitarian disaster written all over it. People are starving. There's no medicine, and disease is rife through the city. Now they have to worry about the possibility of a Saudi and Emirati invasion. What do you think is going to happen in Hudaydah in the coming days?
Well, I think the problem is not with an invasion happening, because it's already happened about 2 weeks ago, and it ended up in disaster for the UAE militias, the mercenaries of the United Arab Emirates. And you could see all over Arab media, especially like Al Masira TV and Asaha TV, you could see more than 120 bodies. They were counted by Al Masira TV, more than 120 bodies of the mercenaries of the the UAE that tried to invade Hodeidah and were not able to because of the resistance of the Ansarullah. Now, the issue that you mentioned, which is the humanitarian catastrophe, has been on for 3.5 years now. This is not something new, but the new thing is that they have blockaded even the aid that's coming from the UN. That's what's new, which is a disaster for everyone, because the only aid that was going into Hodeidah, which is the port of Hodeidah, which is the only open port to the sea that was allowed, that was allowing aid coming from the UN to enter into Yemen or to the middle and northern Yemeni part of the country, it was the port of Hodeidah. So now it is blockaded, fully blockaded. So the humanitarian cases are going to be disastrous by the day. But what is now a huge question, and it's something for the American public to know about and to write to their senators and to their representatives about, is the possibility of a U.S. invasion to Hodeidah. This is what has been going on for the past 4 days in all of our media. All of our friends, they are from Yemen, they are telling us there's a possibility of an actual direct U.S. invasion, land invasion into Hodeidah, because as I told you, the previous invasion that happened during Ramadan 2 weeks ago by the UAE mercenaries failed. It was an utter failure. So now it seems that the UAE and Saudi Arabia are buying Donald Trump for a possible invasion into Hodeidah, which could cause thousands of deaths and more atrocities for the Yemeni people.
Marwa, the United Nations just pulled out of the city. We're talking about the humanitarian catastrophe in Hodeidah, of course. The United Nations just pulled out of the city. The International Committee for the Red Cross did as well. But there's still United Nations intervention in the sense that the Secretary General and other officials are pleading with the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates forces to call off the offensive, to refrain from taking the city that would inevitably cost so many lives, cost so much suffering. Do you think that there's any likelihood that those negotiations, those pleas will be heard?
There's one only way for these pleas to be heard is for the U.S. to, the U.S. and the U.K. for that matter, to be pushed towards not allowing them to go through with this invasion, which means that the U.N., which means that the states that are represented in the U.N. must pressurize the U.K. and the U.S. for them to stop their allies, because otherwise it's not going to happen. Mohammed bin Salman and Mohammed bin Zayed will not listen to anyone. They will go through because they know, in order to try and break through with this war that has been going on for 3.5 years, they would have to try and stab the resistance in their stomach. And that's Hodeidah. That's the stomach of the resistance, because that's where the aid comes for the people. So if you want to make the people also against the resistance, it's by making the situation even worse for them. Now, whether or not this will stop, again, it's in the hands of the imperial powers. It's in the hands of the US and the UK, or else, again, it would not happen. But the issue here at hand, also what we should like shed light upon, is the fact that if Hodeidah port stays closed even further, and Sana'a airport, as you know, it's not working because it has been bombed several times, it means that not only the people of Hodeidah will be affected by this blockade or this possible invasion, also Sana'a, Sa'da, Abyan, we are talking about cities that have hundreds of thousands of residents that will be pleading for water, for drinkable water. They will be pleading for food. They will be pleading for medicine, because even the medication is hard to get into the inner cities of Yemen. So Hodeidah, if Hodeidah is invaded and if it falls, it will be catastrophic for all of Yemen, especially the center and the northern part of Yemen.
John, Saudi Arabia, assisted in large part by the United Arab Emirates and the United States, launched their war on Yemen at a time of great internal upheaval within Saudi Arabia. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, has emerged as the de facto leader, and the war in Yemen is really his war, right? I mean, talk about how the sort of constellation of forces in Saudi Arabia is playing out in Yemen with their decision to launch, you know, horrific operations like this one that's impending in Hodeidah.
Well, I think your assessment of Mohammed bin Salman is correct. He had no real defense credentials as he was very quickly working his way up to be crown prince before he deposed his cousin. And he needed to make himself look like a military leader. It appears that he's done that at the cost of many thousands of lives of innocent Yemeni civilians.
And of course, of Saudi soldiers as well. We have to put that in mind because he's been fighting with the poor people's sons and husbands and brothers, which is a huge deal. And this is how you either get the support of the people or you get the people to really hate you and want you to go away. And I cannot really read now how the public is being the feedback of the public concerning what's going on in Yemen, because you know we're not allowed even to ask questions because no one is allowed to talk. But the issue at hand as well, when you want to know what's going on in Saudi Arabia, you have to look at what's going on around Saudi Arabia. Like, even if you're going to move away from the Yemeni scene for a bit, but look what happened in Jordan over the past 3 weeks. If you want to know what Mohammed bin Salman is thinking, just look about the chaos that about to be hit or has hit the region around Saudi Arabia, Jordan for that matter, Bahrain as well. Hundreds of thousands of people across multiple cities in Bahrain have been also increasing their protests, and the crackdown has been increasing on them. The Jordan was about to fall just like Syria did, but the king of Jordan rushed to Saudi Arabia, as we all saw. King Abdullah rushed to Saudi Arabia over the past 3 days, and he solved the issue by approving to a lot of points or a lot of demands by Mohammed bin Salman, which have been, by the way, talked through with Netanyahu himself. It was a big deal. Now, going back to Yemen and see what's going on, the invasion that did not happen, or that failure of the invasion that happened with the UAE mercenaries, plus the pleas of the UN telling Mohammed bin Salman to back off and give some space, some air to breathe for the Yemenis, especially at the end of Ramadan, at the beginning of, since this week we have Eid. And even in Eid, even in Ramadan, they did not even let the people live peacefully. And if you also look at how the European states have also been voicing their support for the Yemeni people, and also inside of the UK members of parliament, we have a lot of the UK members of parliament going against Theresa May because of the war in Yemen. And then we have now representatives inside of the House of Representatives in the US also voicing their support for the Yemenis and saying and talking about the horrific atrocities inside of Yemen. So all of these, they are an absolute indication that Mohammed bin Salman is building up the rhetoric and upping the ante against a huge invasion with the help of his allies, the Western allies on Yemen, because he cannot further elongate the war on Yemen because he's afraid that the public might go against him. And this is what has been going on in the southern part of Saudi Arabia. A lot of the tribes in the southern part of Saudi Arabia have joined forces with Ansarullah. This is something that has never happened before because they are fed up. They don't want to fight anymore. They are actually fighting with not only with their neighbors, but with people who they have relatives with, because you know, people, when they are residing at the borders, they tend to marry from one another in the Arab world. So basically, this scenery in the entire region just indicates that Mohammed bin Salman is at the pivot point right now. Either he does something to try and take the balance away from Ansarullah and try to win something on the ground in Yemen before going to a political resolution, or at the end of the day, he's going to have to stop the war and go back to a chaos inside of his own kingdom with maybe cousins and other members of the regime going against him and telling him, look what you did. You pushed us into a war and we lost the war.
I think that's true. And, you know, getting back to your point just a few minutes ago about the possibility of a U.S. intervention, this is actually a very serious discussion that's taking place in Washington right now. And it's only been obscured because there's been so much news about the Singapore summit. But here in Washington, the State Department, the Pentagon, the National Security Council, there's a real conversation going on about direct aid, is what they're calling it, to Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And in fact, one of the assistant secretaries of state is shuttling between the two cities. I wish we had more time. We have to stop there, though. We were joined from Beirut by independent political analyst Marwa Osman. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Today, we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us from San Francisco. He's a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, I saw a very unusual television commercial a couple of days ago, I just expected when it started it would be one of your run-of-the-mill political commercials, because there's a primary in Virginia today, as there are primaries elsewhere around the country. But this one was about Social Security going broke, which was news to me. I thought that Social Security had so much money that Congress was actually improperly borrowing against it. But this commercial said that people are just getting older and there aren't enough young people paying into the system, entering the workforce, and we're running out of money. Is that true?
Well, this news pops up every once in a while on the headlines that Social Security is doomed and that we're going broke. The truth is that Social Security does have a tremendous amount of money in its trust fund. But given the rate of retirement and the rate of new people being added to the labor force, it will not be able to pay out full benefits by projected about 2034 or thereabouts. And we have to be really careful when we examine this, because there's a lot of political opportunism that'll jump in and try to argue, well, what we need to do about it and what it means. It means the government's inefficient. It means that we should privatize it, some on the right will say. But we need to be intelligent, because there's a couple of reasons why it's struggling and why it has struggled. Part of it is true. The number of people being added to the labor force has gone down. So there used to be over 3 people for every retired person who's drawing on those benefits. And now it's down to like 2.8. Before it was like 3.3. But another very important thing is there's been this huge tax cuts given to corporations in the recent GOP bill, which means that there's less tax revenue going to Social Security. Additionally, we've ended DACA. So there's all these Dreamers who were before paying into this program through their taxes, who now will no longer be paying into it. They won't be able to work here, at least legally. And if they're working here illegally, they're certainly not going to be paying into any program. So it's a little dishonest to talk about, you know, government inefficiency or the need to privatize. Really, the truth is the money is there. We're the wealthiest nation on earth. We can most certainly pay for it and afford it. But we're making these very destructive fiscal decisions that are allowing those at the top, those at these massive corporations, to benefit. And in turn, Social Security is being hit and could potentially not be able to pay out full benefits in the next decade and a half.
The last time that there was a serious push to privatize, or at least partially privatize, Social Security, I believe, was under the George W. Bush administration, right? Where, you know, they wanted to implement a policy where people would be able to take a portion, I believe, of their Social Security, you know, retirement savings and basically invest it, you know, use it to make investments on the market. I mean, my God, what a disaster that would have been, because that was proposed just a couple of years before the 2008 financial crisis. I mean, the worst economic crisis, worst stock market crash, I believe, since the Great Depression. I mean, it's really a dangerous prospect when we're talking about the privatization or considering the privatization or partial privatization of Social Security.
Absolutely. I think that what we've seen in the last few decades is this move away from these very safe government programs or very carefully regulated pension funds, which whose purpose is really just to preserve the money, cause it to increase at a steady rate so that people can retire on it and live lives of dignity. But what we see now, for example, is 401ks have largely replaced pension funds, and 401ks are privately managed by investment firms that make billions of dollars on them. And they're certainly salivating over the possibility of the Social Security fund, which is, I believe the trust fund is about $3 trillion. So if you can imagine, if your management fee is, you know, 0.01%, that's still an absurd amount of money to be making managing trillions of dollars, which is exactly what they want to do. And of course, they want to do more than just manage it. They want to speculate with it, because that's where there's potential to make real money. And when you're speculating with other people's money, in this case, taxpayers' money, it's that much easier because it's not your own money. So what we've seen is this rollback of, you know, company pension funds, which were carefully regulated, invested in very boring, kind of simple vanilla investments, to this push by finance capital, by the big banks and by Wall Street, to privatize this so they can get their cut. It's not about making it more profitable. It's not about making it more safe, you know, for the consumers. It's about allowing them access to this, you know, absurd amount of money. But the truth is, this isn't, you know, a speculative investment for people. This is their future, so that they could retire and lead a quiet, dignified life with housing, with healthcare, with, you know, food and such, and see their grandkids, et cetera. It's not for, you know, Wall Street speculators to try to make money off of some kind of complex foreign exchange derivative swap or something like that. But that's exactly what they'd like to see this money go to. So we need to be careful when we look at the headlines when they're saying Social Security is going bankrupt. What a lot of people, what a lot of disingenuous analysts will say is, and therefore we should privatize it because somehow that's going to be better. And it most certainly will not. As Walter pointed out, if it was privatized prior to the 2008 crash under George W. Bush, I mean, it would have been a disaster, a financial catastrophe.
Daniel, tell us also how Medicare plays into all of this as well. The costs are going to go up naturally as more states allow more people to sign up for it, right?
Yeah. So as more and more people utilize it, there is going to be a more need to draw on it. I mean, the Disability Benefits Fund also is being impacted as well, which is obviously not the same thing as Medicare, but, you know, is somewhat adjacent to it. So as more and more people utilize it, there is the need for more and more to be paid into it so that the kind of younger generation can sort of pay for the older generation's disability or Medicaid or et cetera. Again, I just want to emphasize, you know, we spent some $700 billion on our military budget without question, without argument. It was across both of the aisles. It was signed on to. And there's clearly a huge amount of wealth that's available for public spending. And so long as we're thinking about, you know, spending $700 billion to, you know, drop bombs on small villages in Syria or, you know, wherever else we decide is our next enemy, these programs, which are necessary to preserve human life, necessary to allow citizens to enjoy medical care and retirement, will in turn suffer because of it. So the question is not how do we get enough money? The question is not improperly managed finances. The question is, do we as a society prioritize the creation of weapons that take life, or do we prioritize programs that foster life and protect life? And right now, unfortunately, the people at the kind of echelons of power have prioritized an industry that takes life over preserving life. And so there needs to be a significant fight back so that we can enjoy the very basic benefits, the very simple benefits we get from Medicare and from Social Security, because we will most certainly need it in the future.
Daniel, you send along another article from the Wall Street Journal. It's titled "The Fed's Biggest Dilemma: Is the Booming Job Market a Problem?" What are your thoughts on that piece?
Yeah, so this piece talks about how the unemployment rate has dropped significantly. It's below 4%. And it really hasn't been that low. It's, I think, a 3.8 since the 1960s. The reason why I wanted to bring it up is, you know, the kind of talking heads and economists and especially the corporations will say that they want a strong economy with jobs for everyone and good pay. And if, you know, these mean regulators and politicians would just get out of the way, they could make that happen. But what we're seeing now is that under the current, you know, financial system that we have, a low unemployment rate can actually cause tremendous economic problems. And so in the 1960s and into the 70s, for those of you who maybe don't remember, there was a significant crisis of inflation, and it was a huge economic problem. The rates of the costs for day-to-day goods like milk and bread and stuff like that were going up significantly each week. There was a market increase in it, and it was, you know, there was pandemonium. So it was a significant financial crisis, and they're worried because it hasn't dropped that low since back then, and they're worried that this is going to push in that direction. So really what happens is if more and more people are employed and they're receiving money, a wage, and then they're putting that wage out into the market, they're buying goods, they're putting dollars out there to buy various goods and services and things, this increases the amount of money in circulation. And the amount of money in circulation, when increased, can cause inflation because too many dollars drop the value of dollars. It's a simple supply and demand. And so if that extra supply of dollars is not met with sufficient demand, it causes the value of the dollar to weaken and go down and go down. And suddenly goods become more expensive because what a dollar could buy before, a dollar can't buy now. And so the article is about the Fed considering raising interest rates, which is a way of artificially restricting the money supply. So trying to reduce it by literally taking money out of circulation and destroying it. So they pull money out of circulation as a way to try to cool down the economy is usually what they use the term. But what I want to point out is that there will be a number of downstream effects to this. So first of all, I think we have to acknowledge that we live under a certain system where a low unemployment rate is bad, where it systemically threatens things, where the idea that we should all have a job and be working hard, and if we're not working, it's because we're lazy or we don't care, is simply untrue. If everyone had a job, all of a sudden, if the unemployment rate was actually zero, it would be a financial catastrophe. But secondarily, the Fed is raising interest rates, and that's going to have a really significant impact on the stock markets. So in 2008, the interest rates were dropped to zero and kept at zero for far longer than they ever had. And this was a way to try to manage the financial crisis, to try to get profitability back to the corporations. So money was extremely cheap, no interest rates. So what happened? Well, people that would normally invest in the treasury, invest in government bonds and get their little percent, stopped because the interest rate was so low, they weren't making any money. So a tremendous amount of wealth flowed out of those bonds into the stock market. And that's where we've seen the stock market pumping up over the last decade or so, just with this nonstop up and up and up. Well, imagine now if we start raising the interest rate of treasuries. Well, now people are going to be incentivized to pull their money out of the stock market and put it into treasuries because that higher interest rate will be appealing. This is going to cause a huge deflation in the stock market. This big artificial bubble we've created by making other investments artificially low is going to cause a huge deflating in that in the stock market and all the kind of attendant results to falling stock prices, the panic, the sell-offs, et cetera, et cetera.
Daniel, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. We are out of time. We were joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel's a financial policy analyst, and he joins us every week to talk about the economy. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Maine has instituted ranked choice voting, or instant runoff voting, which some argue is more fair than most voting systems used here in the United States. The first statewide vote with ranked choice is taking place today. It's in the state of Maine. How does it work? And is it really more fair? We're joined from Maryland by Drew Spencer Penrose. He's the legal and policy director at the election reform advocacy organization Fair Vote. Drew, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Drew, I've been following the news reports today and yesterday about this this ranked choice voting, but I'm still not really clear on exactly how it works. Can you explain it?
Absolutely. So for voters, ranked choice voting is very straightforward. You have candidates on your ballot. You're allowed to rank them in order of choice. So you mark your first choice and then your second choice and then your third choice and so on, all the way through, you know, the seven candidates in the Democratic primary today or the four candidates in the Republican primary for governor. There are also ranked choice voting elections for Congress and for state legislature in Maine today. And for voters, that's basically the end of the process. You'll do best if you honestly rank your first choice, your favorite candidate as your first choice, your second favorite as your second choice, and so on. Now, the way that it works to ensure that the outcome is fair is that you look first just at the first choices. And if a candidate has a majority, more than 50% of those votes, then that candidate is going to win the election just like in any other contest. But if no candidate has a majority, instead of votes being wasted because they were split up among a variety of candidates, you'll actually eliminate the candidate in last place. And if your favorite is eliminated, then your ballot will count for your next choice instead, rather than being wasted. And you just continue like that until you get that head-to-head contest between the top two candidates. And then the one with the majority of votes in that head-to-head contest is the one that will be elected. So it's a way of preserving majority rule without the need for a second runoff election. Voters can vote just once in a way that allows them to have a more expressive ballot, you know, to be able to say more about what they think of the various candidates. It encourages the candidates to campaign in a way that's more civil with each other, you know, because you don't want to alienate an opponent because then their voters aren't going to rank you second. So what we see are places that have this, the candidates campaign strongly with a positive message about policy to the voters rather than going after the personalities of their opponents. And, you know, when we see it in action, we see a lot of positive results. Santa Fe, New Mexico just used it for the first time earlier this year for their city elections. And a majority of voters not only liked it, but said that they would support expanding it to more elections. They want to keep using it in Santa Fe. and potentially more places too. And since then, not surprisingly, we've seen another city, Las Cruces, New Mexico, adopt it. Maine, though, is particularly exciting because these are state and federal elections. Right now, all the other places that are using ranked choice voting are doing it only for local elections. So being able to see it in this context where it's everyone in the state is really exciting, and it'll be great to see how it goes.
So you've made a couple of important points. I want to reiterate them. First of all, I would have never thought of this changing the negativity of a race and making a race positive, because you're right, you don't want to alienate people who otherwise might put you second. Also, this now prevents the appearance of a spoiler in the race, because somebody's going to end up getting a majority of the vote at some point. It might be in the first round, it might be in the sixth round, or somewhere in between. So the spoiler thing goes away. On your website, there's a quote by Grace Ramsey, Deputy Outreach Director, that I wanted to read. It says here, Republicans were just nominated in key U.S. Senate primaries in Indiana, Ohio, and West Virginia with less than half the votes. And one Republican contest for an open congressional seat in West Virginia was won with only 24%. Both parties would benefit from following Maine's example in the use of ranked choice voting. So this really does make it a more fair election.
That's absolutely right. It's no coincidence that Maine is the first place to do this. They have a long history of independent and third-party candidates running strong campaigns, and that's really undermined people's confidence in the outcome of a number of elections. Republicans, Democrats, and independent candidates have all won election to high office in Maine with less than 50% of the vote. Most recently, their current governor, Governor Paul LePage, was elected for the first time in the 2010 election with something like 38% of the vote. The candidate in second was actually the independent. When he ran again in 2014, the independent did not come in second, came in third, but it was the same independent running. And there was again a split vote. This time, Paul LePage got a lot closer to 50%, but he still won with less than 50% of the vote. And that really undermines people's confidence. Now, we can't say that he wouldn't have won under ranked choice voting. We have no way of knowing how the voters would have ranked their choices. But his opposition was really able to undermine his election as a result of that. And it creates a lot of uncertainty in people's minds. So even when the outcome doesn't change, it does help to reinforce the outcome to show that, yes, this really was somebody that was preferred by a majority of the people who had an opinion, you know, just like a runoff election, except you don't have to hold that second runoff election. You don't have the lower turnout in the second runoff election where you're excluding the people who maybe have jobs or families that prevent them from coming out and voting a second time. And that greater confidence in the outcome, the inclusion of third party and independent voices rather than having to shame them as spoilers, that's all really important stuff.
The introduction of ranked choice voting in Maine, of course, that's a first for the United States at the state level, but it's not unprecedented internationally. I believe Ireland has a similar system in place for its elections. Talk about, you know, other places around the world that use either the same system that Maine is now introducing or something that's quite similar.
So that's true. It's used in a lot of other countries. The first place to really pick it up and use it widely was actually Australia. And Australia still uses it for the elections to their house, their federal government. Today, they use a multi-winner form, which is actually a form of proportional representation for their Senate. Ireland, same thing. They use a mix of multi and single winner ranked choice voting. New Zealand, Malta, Northern Ireland, Scotland, all of those places use it for some elections that are taking place at the federal level, meaning that every single voter in those countries is using a ranked ballot for some election. It's used in local elections all over the world much more commonly and in private association elections. In fact, if you pick up the copy of Robert's Rules of Order that you undoubtedly have on your desk, I have a copy of Robert's Rules of Order, you'll see that it says that if you've got an election for one office and it's not possible to get everyone in the same room together to vote, because then you can just do round by round voting like you do in a parliamentary body, then you should use a ranked ballot. And you should send everybody a ranked ballot. And if nobody has a majority in the first choices, you eliminate the candidate in last places. They call it preferential voting. And because it's recommended in Robert's Rules, We see it in use in private associations all over the place, including for the nomination of candidates and many political parties. For example, in the UK, they use it for the nomination of leaders of political parties.
One question, Drew. I'm looking at an article that appeared this morning in Vox, and it has a picture of the ballot for the general election for the office of mayor of Portland, Maine. And there are 15 people running for mayor. So there are 15 names on the left-hand side, and then there are 15 columns where people have to rank their candidates from 1 through 15. So you have all these little ovals that you have to fill in. Might this be too confusing for some voters?
So 15 is on the high number for most of these contests. We're not seeing that many. The most that Maine will be dealing with today is 7. That's the largest number of candidates in any particular contest. In Santa Fe, the largest number was 5. That's a much more common kind of candidate field. That said, most voters in Portland use the ranked ballot just fine. Voters aren't required to rank every candidate, and what we'll see is that a supermajority of voters will mark at least, of the voters that mark at least one candidate, a supermajority will rank 2 or 3. Beyond that, fewer and fewer voters choose to exercise their rankings, but a substantial number of people will absolutely go through and rank all 15 candidates, 1 through 15. When you've got an important election for an important office and you really have a sense of who these candidates are, we see that that's important to people. I mean, as an example, we did polling for the Republican field prior to, or we worked with a group who did polling for the Republican field prior to the 2016 election. Now, if you remember, that was quite a large number of candidates that were seeking the Republican nomination for president. And we saw that a majority of the people polled chose to rank every single candidate. And that's because that race is very high profile. People knew who all of the candidates were and had an opinion. If it were vote for one, you're severely restricted. Thinking about those other countries where this is more common, when you talk to them about the idea of only being able to vote for one, they'll frequently tell you how restrictive that feels. It really is. It's something we've kind of forgotten because it's become so normal in the United States. But being limited to only expressing one preference is pretty severe when you think about it.
We've got about 45 seconds left. Where do you see this spreading in other states? What should we expect to see coming up?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of momentum for ranked choice voting. Legislation has been introduced in a large number of other states. Some exciting ones, I think, include New York City, which is not a state, but it's a city. They there for their primary elections, for many of their high-level primary elections, hold primary runoffs, which are very expensive and have very low turnout, as we see in runoffs in general. So there's been talk about New York City switching to ranked choice voting for all of its primary elections for municipal offices. I think that would be a really positive development. We saw a bill passed last year in the state of Utah, talking about some people, when you look at the cities that have passed this, many of them are Democratic-leaning cities. And that has made some worry that this is, in some sense, a system that favors Democrats. But like I was saying, with it being recommended in Robert's Rules and that sort of thing, it's really a nonpartisan election. It favors voters in all circumstances. And in Utah, they have a strong tradition of majority rule in their nomination contests. And so the thought of a candidate winning with less than a majority was seen as a real problem. And so they've started exploring ranked choice voting and just recently passed a bill at the state level to give cities the right to adopt ranked choice voting if they want to. There's energy in all sorts of places. I mean, I would add just off the top of my head, there's Maryland, Virginia. Those are places near me, so I'm familiar with them. There's a group in Massachusetts that's doing tremendous work. A group in Oregon, where Benton County most recently adopted ranked choice voting in 2016, and there's efforts at other places. It's spreading like wildfire in New Mexico.
It's the future. We were joined from Maryland by Drew Spencer Penrose. He's the legal and policy director at the election reform advocacy organization Fair Vote. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.